Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There once was a woman from Nantucket.
We always feel it's timely to talk about nuclear weapons and arms control and Iran. But this morning's talk show suggested it's also very relevant to talk about agricultural matters. Secretary Berglund can confirm or deny this, but one of the reports pointed to the fact that there has been a 30% drop-off, decline in the number of students in the land-grant colleges. It's been a considerable reduction in the agricultural reserves in the country. There are certainly have been forces at work in the Midwest that suggest that agriculture is a very vital part of the American problem as we face the future, as well as opportunity. So we're delighted in two respects that Secretary Berglund is with us. One, because of the importance of his subject and the work that he did in the Carter administration. Secondly, because he is the second person who has kindly consented to discuss his president and the presidency in which he worked, the Carter presidency. Bob Berglund was born, as many good people are, in the Midwest.
But not all.
Georgia and other places too.
Of Norwegian immigrant parents, of whom the number is even smaller, but I'm proud to say at least a representative, in an area that is described as bleak but fertile farmland in northern Minnesota near the Canadian border. He studied at the University of Minnesota on an agricultural scholarship. In 1950, he purchased 280 acres of land from a neighbor and became a full-time farmer in this northern Minnesota area.
How do you know all this?
I've been studying. A few more things. President Carter said proudly when he announced his cabinet appointment that he had pledged himself during the campaign to appoint a farmer as Secretary of Agriculture, and he was proud that he was able to announce Bob Berglund's appointment. He was Midwest chairman of the of the regional Agricultural Stabilization and Conservation Service, before that of the State Conservation Service. He was an advisor to Walter Mondale during the first Carter campaign. He was a member of Congress in 1970 and served on the Agricultural Committee and the Small Business Committee. So both in theory and practice, in politics and in study, he has made agriculture what Dean Rusk used to refer to when he said, when you concentrated, you made something your parish. And agriculture has been exactly that. We're very happy that we have Bob Berglund with us today.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure how to go about this matter. Surely you don't want to get into a discussion on agriculture, particularly. It's one of those subjects like clean air and good health. We take it for granted. It is, however, a very important industry because over the thousands of years of our civilization, it mostly has been the basic reason for wars and revolution. It continues to be an important, if often misunderstood, topic. My dad had a favorite Norwegian theme. He says, no matter how hot the hen, it takes 21 days to hatch an egg. There are certain There are certain biological limits in this business that no economic law or rule is going to set aside. If it doesn't rain, the world's in trouble. If it's too hot, the world's in trouble. And so we live on the ragged edge. I think it would perhaps be more useful for me to spend time about the Carter presidency and some of the politics of the business, because after all, that's what drives the the business of government, whether it's this university or any other association. Every group has a government of some kind, and the science of that process is called politics. My life has been in the partisan political world, a world that's undergoing tremendous change because the role of political parties is being reduced. The techniques used in campaigns have changed dramatically in 15 years with the rise and influence of television. We've seen the campaigns for public office change from what was largely a retailing operation where candidates would discuss local issues of importance. And political parties had an important role to play in shielding candidates from various economic and political subgroups. That's going by the boards. Nowadays, campaigning is wholesaling. Hire an advertising agency, hire a polling agency, do the political profiling, do the demographics, do the attitudes by demographic subgroup, put it all in the computer, and run daily tracking changes and keep this posted in the computer, and it becomes a very sophisticated business. And when a tracking group shows that a subgroup is starting to veer, you change the advertising tempo of slightly. Drop something, add something, and this is how politics is run these days. It has become, it is no longer an art, it is a science. And incredibly expensive. Issues don't really count for much, unfortunately. It's image and impressions, people really have allowed themselves to be seduced by the television. This is a bad trend. To make matters worse, we've reduced the role of political parties and we've elevated the role of political action committees. There are now 3,800 of these committees that raise money and contribute to the persons that they believe best represents their narrow interest. And there's no real process by which these narrow interests can be reconciled. And so candidates are bought or rented a piece at a time by these political action committees. It's a devastating process, and I am very critical of it. And I run one. I run a PAC in this life. I manage a trade association. We raise $1 million and we contribute money. Not on some altruistic test, I can tell you. It's on the basis of a narrow litmus test that we've designed. So does everybody else. It's not a good situation. The end of that lesson. I was not a Jimmy Carter supporter. I was a member of Congress, a student of the late Hubert Humphrey. I grew up under his leadership and direction in the populist regions of rural western Minnesota. My parents were populists. They were Republican populists. There were no Democrats in Minnesota until the late 20s, early 30s of any real consequence. And so, as was true in the region from the beginning of time until the Roosevelt realignment in the 30s, everybody up there was a Republican. My parents and my family's politics were what they called the populist Republican brand. They were big supporters of Robert La Follette and of others at the time who ran groups within the Grand Old Party. So the contests were always within the Republican primary ranks. Well, in the 40s, 30s and 40s, this all changed, and the Democrats and the farm labor rights, which was the political offshoot of the old populist party that controlled, and may I say, the populist movement of the Middle West was very powerful. They controlled legislatures. Interestingly, the constitution of good old conservative bedrock Republican Nebraska prohibits investor-owned utility companies. They're banned by the Constitution. Good old Republican North Dakota has a state-owned bank and a state-owned flour mill and a state-owned grain elevator. Good old Republican South Dakota has a state-owned railroad and cement plant. Charles Lindbergh's father ran for governor of Minnesota in 1916 or 18, and his platform was that the state would take over the functions of the Minneapolis Grain Exchange and would take over banks. Populism was a very powerful political force, not always well led, but always well followed. And so I grew up in a home in which my dad said politics is important. I mean, the decisions are made in Washington, and these big eastern trusts, the big banks and big railroads are all crooked. Anybody who's made a lot of money has probably stolen it. And they have to prove their innocence. That was Dad's basic law. Not all bad, actually. I found out something to be said for. That was sort of the essence of populism. And I grew up in that kind of a home, in that sort of environment, and got active in politics and was involved in the local Democratic Party's affairs in various ways. And in the John Kennedy campaign in 1960, up till he was nominated, I had been a partisan and supporter of the late Hubert Humphrey, who was trying to get the Democratic nomination. I'd campaigned in Wisconsin and other places for him, and we failed, of course. And it was in August, I think, or September, perhaps, of that year, 1960, Kennedy had been nominated or was about to be, and most of us were mad. We weren't going to take part in the campaign. Humphrey got the bunch together in the St. Paul Hotel, and he laid the law down. He said, I want to hear no part of this business. The choice is Kennedy or Nixon, and that's no choice. We're going to put aside the old wounds, and so we did, went to work. And my job in the campaign was to deal with Lutheran preachers. I am a Lutheran, and my credentials are paid up. I'm also a Blue Lodge Mason. And we knew that religion was going to be an important issue. So whenever we'd find a Lutheran preacher who got on the high horse about Catholicism and the Pope, I would find a parishioner who gave a lot of money to the church and was also a Democrat, and we'd go and see the minister. And you'd be surprised how that works. We took the sting out of that issue, and we did it one-on-one. It was not done by some grand and glorious debate. It was done with a parishioner who gave money and me, and we went to the preacher. And I mean, it was tough going. Those were often very difficult assignments, but they're effective. And that's how elections are often won or lost. Well, Kennedy carried Minnesota and was elected, and you know the rest of the story. Humphrey was the architect of all this. I grew up in that kind of a rough and tumble political environment, but we knew how to win, and we knew why we'd lose. I was elected to Congress in 1970, ran in 68, and I lost, challenged a Republican who'd been there 10 years, and 68 was not one of the better years for the Democrats. You remember that was the Vietnam War year, and McGovern was nominated as a Democratic candidate for the presidency, and the Minnesota Democratic Party was a disaster. They developed the most unlikely coalition, a coalition of gays and steel workers. And there was no way that was going to work. So, of course, it blew up. I got trapped in that thing and lost my race for Congress. But I kept running, and I was elected 2 years later. And got onto the committees on agriculture and met Frank, and we we're dealing with the problems of agricultural credits and other matters. And I worked at the job by specializing. That's how Congress is run, by persons who become known for their skill in something. And if they don't have skill in something, they're generally of little use to the leadership. They may make the Washington Post and the nighttime news, but they don't make law. And continued to be a supporter of Hubert Humphrey for whatever he chose to run for, and he was usually running for something. 1975, the race for the presidency started heating up, and Congressman Paul Simon, now Senator from Illinois, and I formed a committee to try to draft Humphrey. We didn't know he had cancer, and he didn't tell us. So it was kind of a sad period in my life, but make a long story short, I first met Jimmy Carter in the fall of 1975. There was Carter was getting organized to enter the campaign in Iowa, in other primary states during the year 1976, and came to Washington to get acquainted with members of Congress. It was organized by the Democratic delegation in the Congress from the state of Georgia. And I went there and was not impressed. I thought, this fellow is not very strong. He didn't have Humphrey's booming voice. He didn't have the what I thought was a necessary dynamic credentials. And I thought he was lacking in many respects. And so I thought to myself, no, Humphrey's still our candidate. Of course, Humphrey never really entered the race, and that part is well documented. Carter went into Iowa and brought the Peanut Brigade. I was impressed by that. I had done enough retail politicking to know that this was a very effective way to campaign. He brought persons in from Iowa who men wore white shirts and neckties, and the ladies were properly dressed, and they were well-mannered. And they were methodical, and they just went from door to door and town to town in targeted regions of Iowa. They went only where there were Democrats, and they were effective in getting a core of people out to the precinct caucus on that particular day in February of that year. And the Carter campaign was, we need to turn the scoundrels out. It didn't really matter who they were. We had to rid the country of this this bad influence. We'd just gone through the Watergate episode. The war in Vietnam had been a devastating political event. And the tendency was to look upon Washington as a major problem. Carter ran literally as an outsider. And that was an appeal, a rather appealing strategy. People said, you know, we've had enough of these professional politicians. It's time we find just plain folks. I thought that campaign pitch was nuts. But it did work. I thought it was nuts because I thought the government's got to be run by professionals. It's no place for amateurs. And I thought Carter is organizing a campaign of amateurs, and it's going to be run by amateurs. Well, he succeeded in piling up majorities in Iowa and on into New Hampshire and in the primary races, and later was of course he went on to become the Democratic nominee, along with Walter Mondale from my state. Mondale was Carter's choice. I'm not quite sure why. I really don't know what the chemistry was and all that, because they had not been good friends either. Had no particular problems with each other, but it was just kind of an unlikely arrangement. But after the nominating process, the Democratic convention, Mondale called me and asked if I would help to organize committees of congressional support for the Carter-Mondale ticket, and I said, of course. And there wasn't any question about that, so I did. We we formed campaign committees, and we did the best we could, again, through members of Congress, and used their political organizations back in their districts, because members of Congress have some things in common. They all have good organizations. If they don't, they don't win. Simple as that. And they're very careful about that. I would never share my campaign contributors list with anybody. I mean, nobody had access to my list. It was mine. I built it. I organized it. I kept it. I used it. I mined it. I made it work, and I wasn't going to give it to anybody. And that was true with everybody in politics. It's that way yet today. You just don't share something like that, because I had people on my list that would give me money but wouldn't give any other Democrat. They thought I was an effective member of Congress, and they'd be embarrassed if it turned out that they were solicited by the Democratic National Committee. And I knew that, and so I wouldn't give it to them. And I knew that neither would any other member give me their list to send them letters soliciting money or trying to get some things organized. So we did it through the members. We did it through members of the House and Senate that were willing to use their organization to help the Carter Mondale ticket. Well, Carter won, and I'd only met him once during the campaign. That was at a farm thing out in Minneapolis, or out near there somewhere. He did a fairly decent job. He was not strong voiced, but he was very bright, and he had this thing thought out, and he knew what he was talking about. And I was impressed by the content of his speech, and I had not written it. So he went on to win the election, and I had there had been some speculation in the Minneapolis newspapers that I might be appointed cabinet secretary for agriculture. And this was during the campaign, and I of course denied this. I said absolutely not. As a matter of fact, no one had talked with me. I thought that whole thing is just nuts. I'm running for re-election, and I'm not getting into that kind of politics. Well, I won my own election by a good majority, and the President Carter was elected. 4 or 5 days later, I was called by a reporter at Minneapolis, and he said, how about this cabinet business, Andy? I said, absolutely not. I said, I like what I'm doing. And I did indeed like my work in the House of Representatives. I said, I'm not interested in that. I'm not getting into it. Well, he wrote the story just as I had told him, and Humphrey called me up, and he said, what's this all about? And I told him, he says, well, let me tell you, Carter's not going to be a very good president. He's going to need all the help he can get. and if he calls you, and this is like 12:30 in the morning. I mean, I was sound asleep. He got me out of bed. I was kind of half mad about that anyhow, but he would do that. He'd call in the middle of the night. So anyhow, he said, if he calls you and you have no right to turn him down, you've got the sort of an obligation. And I took the whole thing with a grain of salt and went back to bed, and I said, it'll be a cold day when I'm chosen for this job. Well, about 10 days later, one cold morning, I had a call from Jimmy Carter. Would I come to Atlanta to the governor's mansion and meet him and talk to him? And I said, sure. I had the foggiest idea what that was really about, because I was not campaigning for the job, and I knew a lot of people who were. They had their committees out, and there were farm organization leaders and agricultural bankers and diplomats, and I don't mean in the professional sense of the word, but people who were looking for appointments were running for this job. And so I really didn't think about it. Anyhow, I went to Atlanta and met the president, and we got along well, as a matter of fact, and we talked about food stuff, international economic development, poverty and hunger, and the importance of hunger in world politics, the importance of hunger in the United States, the importance of knowing more about the linkage between diet and health. I mean, the sad irony was that we knew everything about the nutritional requirements of a cow, almost nothing about the human body, that we're going to change all that. Production agriculture would take care of itself. The land-grant universities see to that. What we had to deal with was the other side of the marketplace, the demand side, the human side. And I had long thought that, that was really important, and Carter thought so too, and we got along just, I mean, the chemistry was fine. In that interview, it was Carter, Charles Curbo, and one of Carter's staff people, I think it was Watson, I can't recall for sure. And then a fellow from New Mexico was, I'm sorry, he didn't stay in the Carter staff, he was with the campaign committee. They sat there and he pounded questions for a couple hours. When I left, he said, would I sign an FBI document releasing my access to the findings to, so they could do a field check, security check? I said, sure. So I did, and a couple of days later, the FBI man came out of Minneapolis, came up and called on my mother, and he said, I'm with the FBI, I'm here to talk about your son. She was sure I'd robbed a bank. She knew. Mother was 72 years old, and she just, you know, it, with her, was couldn't imagine. Anyhow, they said, no, he's all right. We're here checking. So they ran the checks, and I passed the test. It was about then the speculation continued. I didn't tell anybody I'd been to Atlanta. And as far as I know, nobody ever found out. Because no one called, and that was fine with me. I went out about my business. The day after Christmas, President's people, he called me. He said, would I take the job? I said, well, only one condition. It had to do with the appointments. The appointments of persons to the department's ranks were an important part of the process. I said, I don't know what your position is on these appointments, but I'm going to insist on control of this. And so he said, well, that's fine. He said, we've got some people who'd like to suggest, and I said, that's fine. So we agreed that I wouldn't recommend anybody that he wouldn't agree to, and he wouldn't put anybody on me I didn't want. Sort of, we each had a veto. And the process seemed to work, rather, it did work well. So I went to Plains, Georgia, and they made the announcement, and we were off and running. Went back again the 3rd of January of 1977. Wouldn't it have been? That was a Carter year, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And he assembled all the persons that were about to go into his government and started to talk about macroeconomic strategy. And it was confusion. There was a talk at the time about the need for a $50 rebate, that we simply had to get the economy stimulated, and the way to do it was appropriate $50 or something for everybody in the country. I thought the whole thing was kind of dumb, but I didn't know anything about it, and I didn't take any part in that discussion because it was beyond me. I left that to the economists and the lawyers and the scholars. Well, anyhow, we were there for about a week, and the game plan changed every other day or so. And they really did have a hard time to get his government organized. But it took off, and I mean, the inauguration did that. We all came into office, and the president kept his word as far as appointments were concerned. They sent over a long list of people that had been involved in the campaign, and I interviewed 5, 6, 7 that looked like they had some skills that we could use, and 4 of them were absolutely super people, well qualified, well trained, good instincts. And when I hired or appointed persons, I looked for instincts. I wanted to see what makes them tick. I did all my investigating was on the personal side of the life. Everybody makes business mistakes, but I wouldn't have anything to do with people that were regarded as a bit shady. They had to be straight arrows or I wouldn't touch them. And I didn't have any problem with Carter in that, because he seemed to attract people like that. They were amateurs in a lot of ways, but they were honest about it. And so his government was really loaded up with honest amateurs. Got off to a terrible start. Some of the president's people regarded Congress as sort of the big legislature, and that if you give it time, it'll go away. I mean, they really believed it. It was unbelievable. We had some terrible meetings over there in the White House. The president brought in people who run the Congressional Relations Office that didn't know the Speaker of the House. They knew his name because they'd read it, but they'd never met the gentleman. didn't know the structure of the committees, didn't know the politics and the sub-politics of the committees, and it was an unmitigated disaster. There were five persons in the Carter cabinet that had had congressional experience. Walter Mondale was vice president. Brock Adams from Washington State was the treasurer and secretary of the Transportation Department. Bob Strauss was the president's, what was he in the beginning? Trade advisor, I think, trade representative. Strauss was an old hand in politics. He knew it. Andy Young from Georgia, had been my colleague in the Congress. He was the president's ambassador to the United Nations. We were kind of experienced political people in the Congress and knew the culture up there. But the people that he put on his congressional relations staff were not experienced. And in the beginning, it was a total disaster. They didn't have any idea how the place worked. And worse, they wouldn't listen. So the relationships with the Congress got off to a very bad start. The president struggled with it. He had really not developed any kind of a cohesive national strategy. And he never did develop one. I think this was his weakness. He was an engineer. And he delighted in seeing pieces and parts. He wanted to see everything move. But he wanted to inspect all the pieces. For example, it was in perhaps in March of that year, we were obligated to present a major agricultural initiative to the Congress because current law was expiring and we had to go back with a new approach. And we thought this one through carefully and decided how we wanted to approach the matter. And I had developed this proposal, a rather lengthy document with the counseling with the Department of State and with the Office of Management and Budget and the Treasury Department and other agencies are involved because agricultural policy is an international event and it crosses all departments and agencies. It's not the kind of thing that's done in a vacuum. So I gave him the president liked to have decision memoranda. He liked Reagan this way. He didn't really like to mix it up in a meeting. He didn't like to get into a debate. He didn't like to hear an argument. He was very uncomfortable. And there were a few instances in which I would argue with someone in the cabinet on the substance of an issue. And the president would let this go on for a while and he'd cut it off. He didn't want to hear it. What he wanted us to do was reduce our arguments to writing. And then gather up others who had dissenting views or additional views and put all this together in a memoranda, and his staff, Stuart Eisen's staff, someone there, would produce a letter over this thing and would sort of state who's for, who's against, kind of give him a body count. And then give him be at the bottom of this thing would be a provision to check yes or no, and then room for comments. This farm thing went over to him with about a 12-page executive summary, about 100-page detailed documentation, and about 600 pages of charts. I mean, it was thick. He called me up on Sunday afternoon. He said, on page 412 on this chart B, I was embarrassed. I hadn't read it. I'll be honest with you. I had no intention of reading it. But he did. And I said, Mr. President, I don't know. He said, you don't know. I said, no, I don't know. I said, I'm at home. Don't you have those papers? I said, no, I don't have them here. Well, okay, get to me early Monday. So I called up the experts Monday morning at 7 o'clock, and I said the president had a question about page 412, chart B. And some technical expert in the Foreign Agriculture Service said, well, we thought that might confuse him. It wasn't very clear. We straightened it out and got it over to him. But he really wanted to get involved and he wanted to see all these parts to be sure that in his judgment as an engineer that the thing would finally run when they were all pieces were all put together. He didn't like the social life of Washington. He did not develop friends in his cabinet. I mean, there weren't any, so far as I know. It wasn't until the third year in his administration that he and Mrs. Carter invited my wife and me to a kind of what you might call a private function in the White House. we'd be invited to state dinners and this sort of thing. That's sort of went with the job. But as far as fraternizing or getting to know his cabinet or his key appointees and various agencies, he never did. He was very much the loner. Mrs. Carter was important to him in lots of ways. She would sit in on cabinet meetings. She formed judgments about people. And I found out later that her instincts were very good. She was able to size up a person and tell whether or not he or she was competent or whether they were incompetent, and they made up for it by being loud. And we know people like that too. She could size up a person and would tell the president, I don't think that fellow has told you the truth. I think there's something more going on here. I mean, she didn't have any evidence. It was instinct, whatever you call it. But it was good at this, and the president depended on her for that purpose. The relations with the Congress continued to go downhill, partly because the president really didn't have an economic game plan. I mean, he didn't have, as President Reagan had, the New Revolution. President Reagan came into office with a slogan, with a platform, with ideas, and with a sense of purpose and a missionary zeal to it. And President Carter didn't want that. He thought those are trappings. I remember in maybe late in the summer of the first year, maybe in 77, we'd been doing a lot of work in developing development programs in Central and South America. Our theory was that if people go hungry, they're going to take up arms. I mean, it's just a natural phenomenon. If their kids go hungry, they're going to start shooting something, or they're going to steal. Yeah, they're no different than we are. And the way to avoid the communists and the others in the region getting control is to deal with this problem of poverty. And we had looked at what Jack Kennedy had started down there in the 60s under the Alliance for Progress and thought it had a great deal of merit. And Cyrus Vance and I and some of our key people thought about, you know, what we ought to do is develop a theme and develop a kind of repackage the Alliance for Progress, but it would essentially be the same approach. Our bases would be economic development, social and economic development and reform. Knowing full well that this would upset some apple carts down there, but it was necessary in order to deal effectively with the problems of the region. We presented the president with his idea, and it didn't get to first base. I mean, absolutely nowhere. He didn't want any part of this. He said, you deal with the problems piecemeal and as they arise, but he didn't want to have any kind of thematic approach to the region's political and economic problems. So we didn't propose it. It just died it never got out of the starting blocks. And so we dealt as best we could with those things piece at a time. He enjoyed that kind of administration. The upside to it is that you didn't get tangled up in any treaty down there or any major initiative that couldn't be supported or was not well thought out and would be an embarrassing mistake and have to be withdrawn. The downside was that we did a lot of good things down there for which he'd get no credit, no political credit whatsoever. He didn't really want political credit. He thought that he'd be judged on merit and that the country would know he was a good president and he did things that protected the public's interest, and he didn't care if the public knew. He hated television. He was no good on TV. He was a disaster. And he knew he was no good, and he wouldn't take lessons. We tried to get him to take some training in this thing. He thought that was dishonest. That's as bad as wearing makeup. He wouldn't do it. And so he just blundered his way through. He was awful. He was bad as Walter Mondale on TV. Ronald Reagan is the best I've ever seen. And I mean, absolutely, hands down, the world's champion. He's been at it 50 years and knows how to do it. He's a professional, television performer. I don't mean that as a criticism. I state that as a fact. And in this political world, that is an absolute requisite. Well, Carter didn't have it, wouldn't train for it, and was afraid of it, so he avoided that part which would have allowed him to get certain credits for certain small wins. You know, every administration has small wins and big losses, and you just hope that the small wins will overcome the big losses when they hit. The Iranian thing of the last few weeks comes to mind. And so we muddled along. The president took a keen interest in the Middle East. He was a biblical scholar. In fact, it was probably in February, a little anecdote, true story. He called me up one day and on the hotline to the Department of Agriculture, and he said, had I recently read the 41st chapter of Genesis? I said, no, I hadn't. I asked about it. We Lutherans didn't spend a whole lot of time in the Old Testament. And he said, go and read that and see if it would work. I didn't have the foggiest idea he was talking about. The first Secretary of Agriculture was a fellow named Joseph, about 3,000 years before the time of Christ, and his administration was down in an area west of Luxor, Egypt. and they set up an irrigation scheme, and they set up the first ever normal granary. And you go back and read biblical history, and you recall that there were the droughts, and that region set up a grain reserve scheme. And when the world went hungry, they had grain. The 7 years of drought, remember that? They had grain, and they became a powerhouse, political powerhouse. The president said, would I read that and call him back? So I read it, called him back. He said, you think it would work? I said, yeah, it'll work. He said, well, let's do it. Fine, so we did. And that's literally how it came to pass. I called the economists, and I said, you won't believe this. And I was right. I didn't believe me. But I said, here's what the president wants to do now. And they just sort of turned all shades of color. And they said, well, I said, you're not passing judgment on the president's opinions in these matters, but the question is, will it work? And he said, yeah, it'll work. I said, well, can we do it? Well, yes, we can do it. I said, all right, let's do it. So we did. I prepared an order for the president, who signed it, and they established a grain reserve scheme, where we took the surplus grains instead of dumping them in the markets and giving the Russians big subsidies and panicking over the surpluses, destroying everything in its path, like flooding a country with cheap grain. What you do is destroy their farming economy. And instead of doing all that, we put this stuff in reserve. And we built granaries and we held. And it worked. I mean, it was a very successful program. It was intervention, of course, and grain companies didn't like it because they would much prefer to have the United States remain a grain colony for them. Well, we installed that grain thing and did it without fanfare. The president didn't want credit for it. He said, people find out, it'll work. And they did, you know, eventually. But it was not done with the usual bells and whistles and fanfare at which Mr. Reagan is so good and Carter was so bad. He had always been a scholar, a biblical scholar, and had a keen interest in the continuing disputes surrounding the state of Israel. And I don't know what all brought things together, but he decided to become a catalyst and try to bring the Israelis and its Arab neighbors together and try to figure out some key to all this. And just exactly what was behind that is beyond me. It's not my, I just don't know. You'll find out, no doubt, if you don't already know. But he did get into the Camp David thing. And I mean, he got into it deeply. He took a very keen, deep personal interest in it. He literally brought that issue into the Rose Garden. He brought it into the Oval Office of the White House. It was for almost a year and a half, it was a total preoccupation with him. He didn't have time for much else. He didn't have time for mundane issues like price support levels and a new highway program. He didn't want to be bothered with that stuff because he was so fascinated by his role in bringing together these traditional enemies of the Middle East. And he had, every cabinet was involved in that process. I was involved. He had me over there, the team of experts doing soil samples and water testing and engineering studies on the feasibility of diverting Nile River water to irrigate the Negev and the Sinai deserts. And we did it, and it was feasible, and it was a part of the scheme. If it had worked, I mean, if it had ever come to a conclusion, those regions would have been irrigated, and they would have used that as a new baseland for the transplants on the west bank of the Jordan River, and old Palestine would have become a Palestinian homeland. And the Israeli irrigators would have been moved to the Negev Desert. We'd have made the Negev into the new Bakersfield, California, or Phoenix, Arizona. That's what it would have been, because it had all necessary ingredients, and someday that's going to happen. About that, there's no question. The president never finished his job. However, the Iranian hostage crisis shot that down, brought everything to a screeching halt. It destroyed him. I mean, it didn't destroy his health, but it certainly hurt him deeply. The Iranian hostages were taken on the 4th of November, 1979. And from that day, he really retreated into the White House. He allowed himself to be taken prisoner. He devoted literally full time to trying to work out their release. And of course, you know the rest of that story. It didn't happen during his time. But he brought that thing into the White House, and as a result, wouldn't campaign, for example. He didn't feel that he was free to leave the White House and the delicate negotiations dealing with the Iranians and others trying to arrange the release of these people, because he's afraid if he left the White House, he may lose an opportunity someplace. Mr. Reagan is just the absolute complete opposite, totally and completely. I mean, there couldn't be more of a stark contrast between two people. The running of their administration than Mr. Reagan and Mr. Carter. The president was involved in with me and the business of the Soviet grain embargo. Sometime in the summer of 1979, the Israelis or the Iranians had blown up two big gas lines leading into the Soviet Union and shut down much of Soviet industry in the Ukraine, in the region adjacent to Iran, primarily three large fertilizer manufacturing plants that were running on Iranian gas. The Russians were really mad about that, and we knew that Soviets were in the warpath. But the Iranians blown up their gas lines, and they started moving arms. I mean, I saw the photography taken from these satellites and these airplanes, and you can read the license tag on a Russian truck. It's that good. Once in a while I hear people say, well, we don't know what the Russians are doing. You tuck that one away, it's pure nonsense. We know. They know everything that's going on there. And the president knew that the Soviets were moving arms and trucks and weaponry and tanks and soldiers and needed supplies and are headed south. Question: what is it about? The president was getting advice from Mr. Brzezinski, who said, well, they're headed for Saudi Arabia. What they really want is a warm water port. There are others who argued, no, they're headed for Iran. They're going to take those gas fields. They're just that mad. Secretary Vance said, no, the problem is the fundamentalist dispute in Iran. There's a very militant group of fundamentalists, fundamental Muslims. I don't know if they're Shiites or some other sort, but anyhow, they were engaged in armed revolution in Afghanistan, and it presented a very serious threat to the Soviet and its large Muslim population in the south of the Soviet Union. That was Vance's theory. I never knew who was right. I didn't get into it. What I did know was that the Soviets were on the march, and it was in December of 79. The president called me and all the cabinet together and said, here's the evidence. I mean, there isn't any question about Soviet movements. The question is, what are their intentions? They never could find out, which bothered me a lot. I thought they should be, with the world's intelligence gathering capacities, I thought we ought to be able to know But the president honestly didn't know what they were doing, and apparently had no way of finding out what their intentions were. So the Soviets kept moving, kept converging, had all this photography and all the intelligence reports. I mean, it was clear that the Russians weren't just on a casual Sunday afternoon drive. And the president had, his advisor said, you got three choices, Mr. President. You either join this issue militarily, be set to move the fleets and the Marines and the armies of America into that region to protect our vital interests. The second choice is do nothing. Just pretend it doesn't matter. Third choice is get ready with economic sanctions. And those were about three that had any teeth to them, aside from issuing, you know, pronouncements and getting all puffed up and mad and issued these dire statements out of the White House. But the belief was, well, maybe the Soviet, maybe they won't invade anybody. Maybe they are just on an exercise. I think it was December 26th or so they invaded Afghanistan, and then it was in the fire. What to do? Three choices: join them militarily, do nothing, let them have Afghanistan, or economic sanctions. And he ruled out the first two and told me and others in the cabinet to start preparing a list of things that we can do to stop shipments to the Soviet Union. The big thing was grain. $4.5 billion in grain that the Russians had bought hadn't been delivered. And I told the president, Mr. President, and I had allies in this argument, including Vice President Mondale and Robert Strauss. President, if you embargo this grain, there's going to be pandemonium in Iowa. President Carter was being challenged by Senator Kennedy in the Iowa Democratic Precinct caucuses on the 26th of February of that year. I mean, this is like the end of December. February was the caucus time. There will be political pandemonium in Iowa. You can be sure of that, and you may lose. And Mr. Reagan was making pronouncements about all this, rather sanctimonious pronouncements, because he didn't know anything about it, but that didn't slow him down any. But the president rejected our counsel flat out. He said, I'm not interested in the political implications of this thing. This is a very serious matter. The security of the United States is at stake. And if it causes me to lose the election, so be it. He approached that whole thing very philosophically. He didn't allow me or anybody in his cabinet to even bring up the subject again, namely the politics of the issues at stake. So we went about our business, prepared our assessments of what could and couldn't be done, and it meant withholding some grain, some oil drilling equipment from a company out of Texas, and some Pepsi-Cola and Levi jeans and a few gadgets, including the Summer Olympic Games. That was about it. We gave him the list of things that could be done. And on the 4th of January, he announced the embargo, Friday night. But he instructed me to take such precautions and take such actions as were necessary to mitigate the effects and consequences, which we did. We went in the market and we bought all that grain. We literally bought out the grain company's contracts. The contracts that they had for the Soviet Union, we bought. And we sold it all to Mexico and China. It's true there was pandemonium for a while. I mean, the markets were down the daily limits. We closed the markets for 3 days, and when they opened, they dropped the daily limits, and I went out to Iowa. I was the president's spear carrier in that Democratic precinct caucus fight out there. And you talk about an interesting assignment. Went out there and people were scared to death. I mean, the markets were open and dropping daily limits, billions of dollars at stake. My advice was don't sell. Don't sell. Don't sell. This is not the time to sell anything. This is the time to wait. My counsel was don't sell. Wait this thing out. Well, interestingly, it bottomed out and started back up, and by April the markets were strong, and by the fall they were very strong, and we had the biggest export year in history, as it turned out. We stopped Ted Kennedy in Iowa in that campaign in spite of the embargo and in spite of the economic or the political frustrations caused by it out there. on national interest grounds. We said, yeah, this is a mess. The president had three choices in this situation. He could do nothing and let the Russians have the territory. He could send the Marines and we'd be in the war, or we could do this. Those were the only three choices he had. And people said, you know, you're right. You made the right choice. Don't like it, but it was the right choice. And Carter beat Kennedy in Iowa rather handily, and went on to beat Kennedy elsewhere, and continued to with the campaign and got nominated. It was April, I think, of 79, they attempted the helicopter recovery of the hostages, a disastrous thing, and I recall. I had a call. I didn't even know it was happening. It was being conducted by the National Security Staff. That sound familiar? And I was not aware of it, of course. I didn't expect to be. I mean, that wasn't my thing, so it was no surprise to me that I had been kept outside of it. But there were lots of others in the government that didn't know about it either. That was bad. I had a call at 4 o'clock in the morning, Jack Watson, that there'd been this terrible accident in the deserts in Iran and lost these soldiers, and horrible thing has happened, and be an emergency meeting of the cabinet at 7 o'clock. So I got up and went in. I didn't know what happened, because nothing had been released to the news yet. We were told what had taken place and why it had gone wrong, what they were trying to do. And we were all asked to engage as best we could in damage control, dealing with our respective constituencies to inform them of what was attempted and what had gone wrong and why. And it was devastating to the president. I could tell that he had, I don't know if he had been in tears, I couldn't tell that, but I could tell he hadn't slept. He was, he looked awful. He looked just absolutely beaten and destroyed. I have never seen a person destroyed, but I've imagined what they must look like, and he looked like I imagined they must be. He was drained emotionally. He was drained physically. He was a beaten man, and it was really from that day hence that he withdrew to the Rose Garden. I mean, he wouldn't come out to campaign. Couldn't get him out of the White House. I mean, well, even before that, during the Iowa Precinct Caucus thing, he wouldn't come out there and campaign. He had Mrs. Carter and me and a couple others in the cabinet to do the job, but he wouldn't show up. He said, I can't afford to leave the cabinet. I can't afford to leave the White House. We've got these terrible problems to deal with. And so he didn't. He stayed there. We served as surrogates in the electioneering process. Came out as far as the nomination was concerned okay, but of course Mr. Reagan took up the grain embargo issue as a big cause celeb. Turned out that was pure bunk. I mean, it was a phony argument. The notion that the embargo was the cause of all our difficulties was just not true. But Reagan didn't know that. Somebody told him it was true, and so he liked the idea and he peddled it, and it had currency, carried a life of its own. Just 2 weeks ago, the department issued a new report on this thing and said, you know, the president's wrong. The embargo did not have any impact on the Russians or anybody else for that matter. Embargoes are very interesting political devices with absolutely no economic consequences. What happened was that we denied the Russians 11 million tons of grain, and they bought it from the Argentinians and from the Thais and the few other places in the world. The Argentinians had to cancel contracts to deliver grain to the Italian and Spanish and Japanese mills, and we got all that business. We got the Japanese and Italians and Spanish, and the Argentinians got the Russians. That's what happened. I mean, the grain sold, and the grain was used, and the prices were strong, everything's terrific, but President Reagan had the grain growers believing that they could make more money. He appealed to their greedy instincts, which are profound. And they liked what he said, and they voted for him in large numbers. And Carter went on to lose for a lot of reasons. It wasn't just the grain thing. It wasn't just the farm thing. It was probably the main problem he had was that he was unwilling to play hard-nosed politics, unwilling to really package things together. I mean, he'd been advised by his counselors to leave that hostage thing alone. Just don't touch it, Mr. President. This is a this will do you in. He said, I can't. What are you talking about? Don't touch it. It weighed him down to the point where he was not an effective president. And he lost. Kind of the end of the story. Unless there are questions, and I hope there are.
I'm sure there will be. I think we all have learned a lot about Mr. Carter and about his presidency. I was thinking, as you mentioned, this mutual veto that you and the president had on appointments. That kind of a thing has come up. It's come up in this commission we've had on presidential transitions that Cy Vance and Bill Rogers co-chaired. And apparently it isn't something that was true in either every administration. Ted Sorensen said President Kennedy would never have allowed that with certain key people, and it wasn't even true. Cy Vance wasn't absolutely sure he could bring it off on State Department appointments. So this has been a very rich presentation in terms of some of the players and people, but it has also in terms of some of the fundamental issues that Jim Young and his colleagues wrestle with in our research program here. So terribly grateful for that. Who'd like to ask the first question? Yes, Mr. Harbaugh. You've got some agricultural.
Yes, oh, I remember.
Here.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Secretary, would you comment on the Carter transition team? Did you have a role in selecting any members of the transition team? What is your appraisal of their qualification, I think, particularly in foreign affairs?
I can't speak to the foreign affairs side because I didn't know those people. I knew about those that were assigned to agriculture. Yeah. The head person was Stuart Eisenstadt, and the main person we dealt with was an economist who had been involved in the campaign as an advisor, and a competent person who is not skilled in politics. Didn't really know people. He knew economic theory. Very good at that. Anyway, he and I got along fine. I mean, my nomination was imminent. Then I was given a small office at the Department of Agriculture. As soon as my nomination was announced, the first thing I did was I called all my living predecessors. I called Orville Freeman and Earl Butts, and I couldn't get a hold of Secretary Benson. He was gone. The country, I recall. But I called the others, and it was a marvelous experience. I remember when I called Orville Freeman, who was the last Democratic secretary, I told him what was about to happen. And he said, wonderful. I said, what's the first thing I do? He said, find Audrey Warren. I said, who's she? He said, she was my secretary, and she knows more about running this place than anybody around here. So I found Audrey Warren, found her lodged in an agency somewhere, and I said, Audrey, will you come back? She said, you don't even know me. I said, no, but Orville Freeman said you knew more about this place than he did. Mm-hmm. She'd been there for 30 years. And so I found her and brought her back. Best move I ever made. The transition team itself, though, was helpful in that they gave me names of people that had been involved in the campaign, and as per the Carter deal, I agreed to look them over and interview and take as many as made sense where they'd fit and reject the rest. And they didn't. They knew about the deal that the president and I had, and they never tried to override it. And it's a march to find and install people in positions of authority, to develop the budget, to develop the new agricultural programs that had to be up there on the Hill before the 1st of April. All this had to be done in a period of 90 days. Impossible. Absolutely impossible. There is no president, I don't care who or what or under what circumstances, that can do an adequate job in that short time frame. Now, I don't know any way to avoid it, unless we hold elections 1 year ahead of time.
I had rather jaded experience with the foreign affairs people.
Well, did you?
I think Miss Lillian selected the member of that team. We had 1 year in India with the Ford Foundation. We were newly assigning a agricultural officer to Sweden. The normal procedure is you invite the Swedish agricultural counselor and his wife to your home with our new appointee and his wife, get them acquainted. So when they get over there, they are feel more or less, at least they know the Swedish representative here. Well, the chap, first he wanted to know what time I quit. Well, I normally 5:30 is the quitting time. We never got away till past 6, quarter after, and I told him so. And then he wanted to know whether I had a carpool. This was an essential. He got into my car and he wanted to know what mileage I was getting on the old Cutlass because of the fuel shortage at the time. He rode a bicycle while he was in Washington doing the job. So the experience, and that just drove a curtain. I mean, as you say, they were not kept to the social side of this thing. It just dropped a curtain. There was no communication at all with those people. We were different sort of people, I guess, and the kind that they didn't particularly like.
Well, one day I had a telephone call from a fellow named Hugh Carter, who was in the White House. They later come to call him Cousin Cheap. And Cousin Cheap called me up and he said, "How many television sets are in the Department of Agriculture?" And I said, "I haven't the foggiest idea and I don't care. Who are you?" "I'm Hugh Carter." "Well, that's interesting. Are you related to the president?" "Yeah, I'm his cousin." "Okay, what can I do for you?" "How many television sets you got?" "I said, I don't know. What's this all about?" "I said, well, we're on a campaign to find out how many TV sets there are in the government around here that we could get rid of." "So we got 82 of them in the White House." I didn't think much of it. I didn't really care, to be honest with you, and I told him so, and he was furious with me. But I didn't tend to matters like that. I never did answer him. I had a Mercury, leased Mercury automobile that was there when I came, a couple years old, leased from Ford Motor Company. It was a nice, adequate automobile. Got word from Cousin Chief that all those Mercuries were going to go. I had my pick of small cars. And I got a little Oldsmobile. It didn't have windows in the back. It had, they wouldn't crank down. And I said, "I'm not going to ride this stupid thing." I mean, they put me in the back seat, and I've got the Capitol Hill. I have to sit crossways. So I told my driver, Tommy, I said, "I'm not going to drive this thing." I had a car at home. I had a perfectly good four-door Plymouth sedan. I said, "Why don't we just drive my car? You drive it." So nobody will know the difference. "Oh, no, Mr. Boss, we can't do that." Well, they finally relented, and I got something to afford. But they did. They went on this kick about the savings thing. It was symbolic. It was fashionable to turn down the temperature and save. It's the same thing that drives a lot of people of the Depression era. Save, don't waste. My mother and dad, same thing. I grew up in a home, and what the folks said. You took it in your plate, you eat it.
Did they allow you to eat keep it, your too. Parking space?
What?
Did they allow you to keep your parking space?
Oh, yeah, I kept that. Yeah, oh, yeah.
We had to map everything out and how many miles you were from there, and I ended up driving about 3/4 of an hour picking up secretaries and everything else, no longer an executive spot. Didn't matter that you got there earlier to do more work or stayed later on business. You still had your carpool.
General, what about you?
Mr. Secretary, I'd like to come back to your Political Action Committee statement. I've referred to it here before. Senator Robert Byrd, one evening, for whatever reason, had me in his leadership office and was bemoaning the fact that he could no longer exercise his authority as the majority whip because every senator was an independent entity rather than have political party discipline. Am I correct in observing your view and his concern with the recent statements in the paper that the Democratic leadership is going to try to do something about political contribution committees?
They are going to try to curb their influence and the abuse that arises from it. It's a corrupting process.
Well, as a quick observation, I believe they have caused a deterioration in our right of representation in a democracy, and as such, I'll be delighted if you can change it.
I don't know if it can be changed because there's so many people like me around that don't want it changed. I mean, there's 3,700 PAC administrators around the country that are gathering and distributing money. And it's big business. I mean, it's millions and millions and millions of dollars. And I think it's a disaster, and we run one. I run it hard, I run it clean, we raise a lot of money, and I'm good at it. I'm as good as they come. But it's an awful thing we're doing. And it'll change. I think there'll be limits put on it. I was in Congress during the 70s, during the period of Mr. Nixon's problems with the Watergate matter, you recall all that? Which led to major reforms in the Congress. Up until when I first came there in 1971, the Congress was really run by about a half dozen people. The Speaker, at that time Mr. McCormick, and Mr. Rayburn before him, and Mr. Alberts after, along with the Chairman of the Appropriations Committee, Mr. Mahon, and the Chairman of the Tax Writing Committee of the House, Mr. Mills, and the Chairman of the Armed Services Committee, Mr. Hebert, and three or four very senior gentlemen ran the House. Ran it efficiently. They decided on committee appointments, and they were decided on the basis of political considerations. These were political people. And they were tough disciplinarians. I mean, not a close vote in the House, no Democrat straight off the reservation. Not very often. Because they would they get chopped off their committee. I mean, it was tough, hard-boiled business, but it was efficient. And when the 74 election came, the Democrats got big majorities in the House. Reforms were initiated, some of which were needed, and I joined in. Some of those reforms, we made big changes, and we stripped the chairman of their authority. They became presiding officers. We democratized the House to the point we couldn't make a choice. All I did was argue. Committees would argue endlessly, just go on and on and on, and it sort of reinforced an old notion that a democracy can't function because it'll never choose. And for two or three years, the House was completely out of order. Now it's gone back. It's taken on a more moderate stance. Still elect the chairs of the House, but they've got authorities now, and we're providing more authority to the Speaker and more control, as it should be. Absolutely can't run a committee of 435 persons by anarchy. Can't run. Same with the leadership in the Senate. Same thing. Fewer numbers, but the principle's the same. And something has got to be done to curb the influence of PACs, the political action committees. I mean, we picked out people. We voted to whom we gave money and from whom we denied money on the basis of one or two votes. Awful thing. Doctors do the same thing, the lawyers, the real estate people, everybody else does the same thing on the basis of one or two votes. And we apply pressures. I mean, I know how to apply monstrous pressures on a member of Congress in a close race on a vote. And, you know, there are laws against how we do it. I can't go up there and say, if you vote yes, I'll give you a check for $1,000. But you don't have to be too smart to figure out the linkage in these matters. It's terrible. And it's really got to be curbed somehow.
Professor Young. I wonder if in your conversations before you took office with the president, Carter, or soon afterwards, there was any discussion about, beyond the appointments, about your access to him, about what he expected you to do, or what his charter was to you, if there was such a thing.
Well, there were a couple of just general conversations. One, he stated early in the formation of his new administration that he was going to use cabinet government. And he kept his word. We had cabinet meetings every Monday at 9 o'clock. Now that meant not 3 minutes after 9 o'clock, it meant 9 o'clock. Anybody who came at 3 minutes late was not allowed in the room. And that happened once. And a cabinet member came in 7-8 minutes late, and the president lectured that member. I mean, fierce. Said the meeting started at 9 o'clock. Everybody understand that? Nine. It's not 5 minutes after. And he was tough on that. Cabinet meetings every and Monday morning, 9 a.m., would run till 11 or so. Some of them were tedious, most of them were interesting. And tedious in that sometimes we had people who just prattled on and they didn't use any, have any sense about propriety and proportion and balance. You know, they take up the cabinet's time with nonsense. But mostly it was worthwhile because it allowed a person like me to sit in and listen to a serious discussion between the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State. And I could figure out what was happening, and I could figure out how I could help the president. In you know, agriculture is kind of far-fetched in agriculture, in security issues, except it's not. Certainly not when it gets into matters abroad. So in that setting, the cabinet process was very useful, and there were many times when I had a problem I would raise with the president and in front of my colleagues that required coordination. And I said, Mr. President, here's what we're trying to do. Here's why we're trying to do it. Here's why we can't get done. The Secretary of Labor has a problem. I let him speak for himself, but there's the roadblock. And he'd turn to Ray Marsh and said, okay, Ray, what's the problem? You know, let's hear it. And there'd be some shuffling and fumbling, and finally it would come. And he said, well, I'll take this under advisement. But he made it work, and he used the cabinet as a discipline. Anytime I needed to talk to him, I could. He made that clear, and he kept his word.
You were never felt you were blocked by staff?
Never. I never was. The staff would put their impressions on top of mine if I'd send him papers on a policy issue that was in dispute or under consideration. But I was never censured. I was never blocked. I had direct telephone access to the president in his Oval Office. I got through, I didn't come through the White House switchboard, I came to the secretary that sat just outside the Oval Office, and I said, I need to talk to the president. He said, well, he's busy now, right now, but he'll call you back, and he always did. He was very good about that sort of thing.
Yes, Professor Fernbach. You, sir, described the president as unwilling to hear an argument in cabinet or elsewhere. It would go on very long. He wanted things in writing. Would you describe further his decision-making process after he got the data in writing and had conflicting views? How did he go about making a decision, or did he not make decisions on the table?
He did make decisions, and he was capable of making those decisions. He did not procrastinate, but he wanted to see all the evidence. I cited this instance of him reading these charts that I hadn't read, and he'd do that all the time. My colleagues over at the Defense Department, where the things are incredibly complicated and much bigger in scale and problems much more intense, they were just absolutely flabbergasted. Harold Brown was the Secretary of Defense, and Harold was telling me one time there was some national defense issue. And I mean, the documentation went into the hundreds of pages, and the president read it all and wanted more, and he called him. He said, you know, he'd gone through this stuff, and he understood it. I mean, he was a scholar and a student, and he learned it, and he remembered it. He was able to recall. I thought he probably loaded up his mind with too much of this trivia, because I didn't have any interest in that particular thing. I found the thing kind of boring, to be honest with you, but he loved it. And he'd make the decision, and he'd do it on the basis of what he thought was required as a consequence of these facts. He didn't care about people's opinions. He didn't have much interest in what people thought. He wanted to know what the facts are, and he wanted to see the hard data. He'd make a choice, and of course, like any president, he expected compliance. He was tougher on compliance than Mr. Reagan. Mr. Reagan allows an awful lot of internal disorder to go on. I mean, I can't quite understand how it can run this way, but that's, you know, people like you will find out someday. Mr. Carter would never allow that. He terminated the services of Joe Califano, for example, for that very reason. Joe kept trying to pull end runs on him, saying, you know, the decision was made, and Joe would say, well, I'm going to try to politic him on the Hill. And finally he got caught up with, and Carter just sacked him. And that was it. It was just, there was no second chance. You either go along or get out. He made that clear early on. There would be no room for disagreement once the choice was made. And he demanded complete and total loyalty to that principle. And I abided by it because I thought it made sense. I wouldn't allow it in my department either. I fired an administrator once. Meaning no disrespect, but the truth of the matter is this person was a fellow I'd appointed to an agency. And we'd prepared our budget. I got control of the budget process at USDA. I wouldn't let OMB get in my business. That's an interesting story in itself. What I did was I set up a committee of every assistant secretary, six of them, plus the Office of General Counsel and Inspector General, and I formed this committee. They call it the murder panel. That's how we're going. And each August, each agency would bring its budget to us, and every assistant program secretary had to get a shot at it. If General Elliott had been there, he'd have found his budget examined in great detail by people who didn't know anything about his business. Well, what it did was bring to the process a discipline that is found elsewhere in government. People ask questions, they don't know anything about the subject. It goes on all the time. So our budget went through that process and we had everything ventilated. And when it got, and the only question I asked of the OMB was, give me the bottom line. You give me my bottom line budget and I'm going to run it within that. And the rest of it's none of your business. And so the first time we went through this process, we developed our budget. It's a bloodletting experience because agencies didn't get what they wanted. I got over to OMB and there was more tinkering and I said, nothing doing. I shut the book, I got up and I walked out of the meeting, took my people with me. And the director of OMB, Mr. Bert Lance, was horrified, or his people were. Bert kind of thought it was sort of funny. But the OMB analysts were horrified that a cabinet secretary got up, took his people and left. And I called Bert and I said, I'm not going through this nonsense. We've got our bottom line complying with the president's wishes. And I want to see the president about this. There's going to be a shootout here as to who's going to run this department, these analysts or me. And he said, it'll be all right. I said, no, it's not all right. I'm not going to go through this. So the president called me over. He said, what's this about? And I told him. I don't know whatever happened, but I never saw any more from OMB. But I stayed with the bottom line, too. I didn't play any games. I didn't go up there then to the Appropriations Committee and say, well, yeah, we're for this, but really what we wanted was this. I played hardball with the Appropriations Committee. I protected the President's budget. And we held the line, more or less. Well, I had an agency administrator that decided he was going to play a cute game. He didn't like what we'd done to his budget, so he went up there and he testified before the committee, and he said, the official number is this, but let me tell you the real truth. This is what we need. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I had a phone call from a staffer on the Hill. He said, let me tell you what happened. You had an administrator up here today, and this is what he said. I said, I don't believe it. He said, well, he did. So I called him up. He came in my office. I said, is it true? He said, yeah, it's true. I said, well, you're through. Just pack up and leave. He was gone by 5. And that's the last time I had a problem with discipline. The president did the same thing. He didn't tolerate discipline. Once the choice was made, that was it. And you can fault him on a lot of things, particularly in matters of concept or his unwillingness to politicize a thing. But can't fault the mechanical parts.
Unless we want to give equal time to the foremost American scholar on the OMB, Professor Mosier, who's been unbelievably quiet.
I think I'm being introduced to something.
you can do it privately unless you want to. Do you have any questions?
The only question I'd have is whether that decision the first year stuck. In future years.
It stuck. But I stuck by the end of the deal. My end of the deal was I'm going to defend the president's budget in the Appropriations Committee. I mean, I was hard-boiled about that. I lobbied members of the Congress on when they tried to exceed the budget. I allowed them to do some jiggling among agencies, but I wouldn't allow them to exceed the bottom line. And believe me, we politicked. But
wasn't there a year when you didn't weren't satisfied with the bottom line?
And I wasn't satisfied?
With the bottom line.
Yes, I was. There were years. And several.
If there were years, didn't then the OMB come in on you?
No. There were years when I wasn't satisfied, but I had a choice. I either took the president's decision or get out. Those were the only choices I had. But I wouldn't play games with them. I wouldn't go up there to the Appropriations Committee and say, well, the OMB forced me to do this, but this is what we really need. I'd been a member of the committees of the Congress and had an advantage in that regard. I knew that I couldn't beat Jamie Whitten with his own committee. Committee on Appropriations. I knew that. So I wouldn't start that fight. What I did, though, was deal with the committees in the Senate. Our main Senate leader at the time was Senator Eagleton, Missouri. And the Senate committees, committee staff and I and our colleagues would go over this thing, and we'd get to the bottom line, and we'd do some sorting out. Mr. Whitten had his own ideas. He had his own agenda, and it was pure rural Mississippi vintage 1938. I mean, it hadn't changed. And I couldn't beat him in his committee, so I'd do my best on the floor, and then we'd beat him in conference. And we usually came out of that thing in pretty good shape. I never played games with the president in this one. And that's why I think he came to rely on me. I was kind of his own OMB. But I wouldn't allow the analysts at OMB to tinker around with what I thought was my business. And it was a big shootout, that one, I tell you. I was difficult for them.
One final question, Howard Brown.
I was curious to know what the reaction, if you can gauge it, was of Mrs. Carter sitting in on your cabinet meeting.
It generally was frowned on. Generally, people thought that they were sort of being snooped on by amateurs. I think that was a general impression. I didn't really particularly like it either, to be honest with you. I was a little uncomfortable, and I can't tell you why. I knew that she was sizing me up, and there was something about it that was just a little bit difficult. I never had any trouble with Mrs. Carter. I never had any trouble with the president. As a matter of fact, he and I always got along. We reconciled our differences. I respected his authority. He and I never had any bad words ever of any real consequence, because I was very careful about money. He was tough on spending. I mean to tell you, he was just brutal on spending. The Reagan people are amateurs, rank amateurs of the worst sort. They haven't the foggiest idea what money's worth. But Jimmy Carter grew up in a home in which money was scarce. And all his life he lived in an environment in which money was scarce and therefore valuable. And he brought that with him to the White House. So money meant a lot to him. His budgets were close. He scrutinized the dollar very carefully. And I grew up in the same kind of a house. So I understood where he was coming from when he talked about no waste. No waste at the dinner table. He never turned anything back in my home. So we had some of these sort of common bonds, a very conservative, rural attitude on money matters. And so we were never in any, I was never in any danger or any trouble with him, and therefore never had no reason to be uncomfortable when Mrs. Carter was in the room and we were in the midst of some fairly heavy discussion. But some of my colleagues rather resented it.
As Wilson Newman and others remind us frequently, this is a study devoted to this is a center devoted to the study of governance and politics. We were told we'd learn a good deal from the Secretary of Agriculture about both of those dimensions. I don't believe we thought we'd learn quite as much as we have. This certainly has been one of the most instructive discussions, Mr. Secretary, we've had in the history of the Center, and we thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.